Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Happy to have you with us today and very happy to have two of our favorite guests. We have Dr. Death and the Garden Hoe. That's quite the little superhero combo there. Dr. Death is also sometimes known as Brian Huddleston. He's director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, always great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Liz Freemuth was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of The Garden Hoe, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She provides concierge horticulture services. Liz, great to have you back and a very happy birthday to you.
Well, thank you for the birthday wishes and always glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
You're really 18 today, right, Liz?
I do. Yes, I'm finally, actually 21. I'm finally
21.
Legal. Yes.
So you can take her out for a birthday libation after the show. Well, we're very glad to have them with us. Between the two of them, they can answer just about any question you might have, and especially questions about what might be ailing the plants in your garden. Last summer was a really tough summer for pretty much everything. And so I know a lot of us are wondering what impact that will have on our gardens in the coming season and also what we can be doing now. I know there's some pruning that can be done. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, and you can also post a question, a comment, or a photo of that ailing plant on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mehler Show, and Mehler is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Well, let's just jump right in here. Liz, with the drought conditions this past year, a lot of plants were stressed. What does that mean for how well they may or may not overwinter this year?
It really is going to depend on their overall health before we really went into the drought. And we have looked at a number of years of drought off and on in certain areas of the state. When you go a little bit further north, they were inundated with water. And you go down this way, and definitely we've had drought conditions. If they were healthy going in, many plants will suffer, but they may survive just okay. Some actually do phenomenally well. I was surprised this year when I look at some of the ornamentals walking around. And as I said before, I do Darwin gardening, so my stuff has to adapt
too.
In my own yard. Because usually I'm out taking care of other people's stuff. And so I trial a lot of things in my own yard. What did phenomenally well in August when I finally got the hose out from my own yard was Amazonia. I was just tremendously surprised, which is blue star flower.
Oh, okay.
And I was amazed that it looked good. Hadn't had any water all year, and it looked good. I expect that to come back and do really pretty good this next year. excuse me. When I look at some of the oaks, I think this next year we're going to see a lot of weakening from the drought, and that actually opens the door to diseases that may have been lingering around the outside edges, but the tree was healthy enough to fend it off. And, you know, so we will see over the next 2 to 3 years some real damage on some of the larger stuff starting
to
emerge.
And also insects on oaks.
Oh,
I'm
absolutely
really worried about
yeah.
two-line chestnut borer on oak trees because that's an insect that tends to be attracted to trees that are under a lot of stress.
And is it more likely that newer plants, less established plants, will feel more severe effects? Or
you know what? That's another one. All of these are, it depends. Not trying to take an easy answer, but but oftentimes it's more of a human nature kind of thing. With a new plant that we put in, we're a little bit more in tune to whether it needs water or not because we've invested in a, you know, relatively recent past.
Right.
We've invested money in that. And so oftentimes we'll get the hose on that or get it watered. Whereas some of those that have been there for a little bit or are established, we'll bypass them with the hose. And so sometimes those new plants will actually do a little bit better because we paid attention.
Because they're
whereas, you know, if we forget about them. But it depends on, you know, whether they're well suited also.
I also think size matters, particularly in this environment, because people oftentimes want an instant landscape. So they really want those large trees and shrubs planted. And this was definitely not the year to have done that because this was a really tough environment on larger trees. You have to keep in mind when you're digging up trees from a nursery setting, you're chopping off a substantial amount of the root system in order to get it transplanted. And with those larger trees, that's really going to put them under a lot of stress. So I think for those folks who planted small stuff, like you said, Liz, it may have made it through quite well, particularly if people were really aware and we're watering on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the root mass is so important. You know, a lot of the nurseries will root prune for years. And so you do have kind of a self-contained root mass that if you can get water on it. But we have to remember that when it's as dry as it was this year, everything else around it is dry. So even if you're watering that root mass, that moisture is being sucked out into the dry mm-hmm. soil that surrounds it. And so you really kind of just keeping it at bare minimum, even keeping up with watering. So definitely. Yeah, and it's a wait and see.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I
hate to say that, but it's a wait and see.
And, well, it was a very unusual period of time. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, there's not a lot to look back to. I know Phil Pelletieri was looking back, talking about insect populations, looking back to the drought of 1988 as maybe a comparable. That's a long time ago. So, you know, especially for something like gardening and a newer gardener, they're in uncharted territory right now.
And oftentimes those cultivars that we're looking at may not have been around in 1988.
Right.
And so we don't have anything to base the response on because mm-hmm. they weren't there. Right. And oftentimes, unfortunately, in the industry, in the plant industry, plants get introduced before they've really had a real long period of monitoring and trialing, et cetera. And so there isn't a lot of history to see what's going on.
What about perennial plants, flowers? What are you expecting, drought, any kind of issues with overwintering after the drought?
Again, I think it depends on how they were cared for during the summer and into the fall.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things, we had a really dry summer. We had a little bit more moisture coming into the fall in some areas. But again, it's always very important to continue watering into the fall. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think September arrives, it's fall, and we don't need to water anymore. Mm-hmm. It's very critical to get water on when we're in a dry period.
Well, and I think when you're looking at the root systems of these plants also, where we really have seen a nice build in the using of natives. And if you're using prairie plants, those actually will probably survive just fine if they were established. Mm-hmm. If they were new plants last year, even those are going to have a tough time because they didn't have an opportunity to send roots down to really grasp moisture 6 feet under. I know when I was digging this year, even well into fall, there was no moisture in the soil at all, period, going down 3 feet. So if you're talking about a plant with a very shallow and very dense root system, if it was kept moist at the top level, it actually might do pretty well. Whereas some of those that might have more of a woody root structure that was down maybe a foot or so, if they weren't watered really well, we would expect to see them not survive particularly mm-hmm. fantastically.
But those native plants, a lot of them have incredibly deep root systems. Like you
Phenomenal.
Said, if they're established.
If they're established. And, you know, again, it's going to be what was your soil? What was the health of the soil? What was the health of the plant that you put in? And you know, some of the plants that I put in my yard are stressed when I put them in. You know, I'll go shopping and I won't name names of places I go, and I'll go to the we're going to throw it out next week area and see what I can do with those and put them in the yard. So if anybody else has done that inadvertently or intentionally.
I do that myself because I want the cheap stuff.
Well, and then there's you buy them and you think you're going to put them in right away and you get a little busy.
So yes.
And all
it's
of
not
us,
only.
All of a sudden it's October. We all have those. Yeah,
I've done that too.
We are talking with Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology, and Liz Freemuth, who was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of the Garden Ho. She provides concierge horticultural services for her clients, and they are happy to answer your questions when you call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And why don't we go to the phone, actually, and talk with Mary in Green Bay. Hi, Mary.
1-2-3-4, and why don't we go to the phone?
Please turn your radio off, Mary.
Yeah, I'm doing that right now.
So what's your question?
Well, I am... I do gardening actually for a living, and I have a garden at home, and last summer was the first time I ran into aster yellow, and I did some reading about it, but I'm not, you know, there's just not a lot written about it, and I'm wondering if there's something you can do to prevent it. I ripped out all the plants that it showed up on last year, but I'm wondering also, is the little hopper the only way it's transmitted? And like I said, what can I do?
All right. First of all, Brian, why don't you define aster yellows?
Yeah, aster yellows is a what's called a phytoplasma disease, and a phytoplasma is a what I call a funky bacterium. It's not a true bacterium, but it's kind of like a bacterium, and it's these particular organisms tend to be transmitted by leafhoppers. This particular phytoplasma, the aster yellows phytoplasma, is transmitted by the aster leafhopper, and we had a real tough time with the disease across the state last year because we had an early influx of the leafhopper into the state. We had higher populations than normal, and interestingly, a higher percentage of the leafhoppers were carrying the phytoplasma. Normally, our vegetable people get excited when about 1% to 2% of the leafhoppers are carrying the phytoplasma, and I believe Phil said we were running about 9 or 10% of them were carrying. Mm. So we had just perfect storm to have a lot of this particular disease. The leafhoppers actually inject the organism into the food-conducting tissue inside the plant, and then the phytoplasma causes all kinds of very bizarre growth distortions. And the kind of the classic symptom on something like coneflower is that the flowers will become very leafy and green. And it's a permanent infection. In fact, in perennials, the phytoplasma tends to congregate in the roots over the winter and then will recolonize the following year. And then the only way to get rid of it is really to remove the plants, which is what the caller has done. And it's very difficult to manage because, again, it really depends on whether you have leafhoppers or not. Mm. And there are other minor ways that you can do this. Experimentally, we actually move it around from plant to plant by dodder, which is a parasitic plant. But the natural way typically that we get transmission is through leafhoppers. So about the only thing you can do is remove the plants. Or if you're like me, I think it's cool, so I keep it in my yard for teaching purposes. But most normal gardeners are going to want to get rid of it. And then it's just a matter of whether we get an influx of these insects from year to year. Now, if you're interested in reading more, we do have a fact sheet on this particular disease. You can go to a couple of websites to find it. It's at our UW Extension Horticulture website, which is hort.uwex.edu, or you can go to my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu. And I'm really plugging my clinic website right now because we just launched a new version of it the first of the year, and I really like to get feedback from folks on how they like it. I think it's much more user-friendly now.
And we do have a link to the clinic, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic website, on the Facebook page. Again, that's pddc.wisc.edu.
Yep, and there's a little widget right on the front page where you can search for fact sheets, and so you can just type in aster yellows, and it should pop up the
fact
sheet.
And it's yellows is plural,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yellows. If you type in aster yellow, it should pop it up as well, but it's technically aster yellows.
Great. All right, thanks for that call, Mary. And let's go next to Bill in Greendale. Hi, Bill.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have a question about trees. Thorn locust, and black ash. On the trees, and it's not on the trunk, it's on the branches, the upper branches. I have either a fungus or a lichen or or mold or something. It's an orange color, and some of it is grayish color, and the trees are about 40 years old. That's it. I'd like to hear what this what I've got and what I should do for
Let's
it.
Let's see what Brian thinks.
Yeah, it could very well be lichens. These are little symbiotic organisms that are a combination of a fungus and an alga. The fungus provides kind of the body of the organism, and the alga actually photosynthesizes and produces nutrients for the organism. And they like to grow on surfaces, and lots of times they will grow on branches. I oftentimes see them associated with some branch dieback, and it's not that they're causing the problem, but I think kind of what happens is that the integrity of the branch kind of declines as the branch dies back, and so I think they get kind of leaky and start to leak nutrients, and then the lichens can use those nutrients as a growth medium. They aren't dangerous. In fact, you kind of want to have a wide variety of lichens in your area because the more lichens you have, the better your air quality. So you often do see them on trunks. You can see them growing on things like rocks. If you go to cemeteries, oftentimes they're growing on gravestones. They're just a whole wide variety. There's a beautiful textbook with beautiful colored pictures
gorgeous.
All
they're
on lichens.
Gorgeous, yeah.
And they're just, it's spectacular the number of variants of lichens that are out there in the world. I wouldn't get overly excited about this. The main thing I would assess on this tree is whether it looks like those branches where the lichens are present, whether those branches are dying back. If that's the case, then you really need to try to figure out if there's some other underlying cause of that branch dieback.
And that's a time to call an arborist.
Right.
And Wisconsin has a lovely system for arborists, for choosing arborists on the website. And
right.
So that's good. What I would actually ask, anytime somebody tells me there's orange coloring mm-hmm. anywhere, is look to see whether that's a mass that looks like a lichen or whether you're seeing small orange dots mm-hmm. that are emerging out of the bark. If there's small orange, almost like pustules that are emerging out of the bark, then you really want to take a look, because that actually signals that there's an internal problem.
Yeah. With his description where it sounded like it was up in the tree,
like,
and if he can see it from there, it sounds more like a mass.
Yep.
Now, if there were orange masses on something like a juniper, then I would worry about a disease called cedar apple rust.
Yeah.
But on the hosts that he mentioned, it sounds like it's probably lichens.
So I want to go back to something you said, Brian, because you said it's good to see a variety of lichen mm-hmm. because it indicates good air quality.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Are the lichen there because it's a good environment, or are the lichen actually contributing to the air quality and making it good?
No, they're probably there just because the air quality
okay.
is
so
good.
So they're kind of canaries in the coal mine.
Right. Yeah, basically, yes.
If it's not good, if it's not a good environment, they won't
right.
be there.
Mm-hmm. And again, if folks are interested in reading more about lichens, we have a really nice fact sheet that's available at our website and talks about the kind of four major groups.
Great. Oh, that's fascinating. Thanks for that call, Bill.
They're a cool organism.
Yeah,
very, very cool.
They're very pretty.
Yeah.
Very pretty.
Great. Actually, we had an email from John who says, I think my birch tree died because of borers. It's completely full of holes. Will these travel to my other birches, and would it be good to cut it down before spring?
You know, where are the holes would be my first question. What type of a birch is it, and what type of other birches do you have in the yard? There are some that are a little bit more resistant to birch borer, but if it's a, you know, this last year with the health being kind of questionable, drought, et cetera, trees are weakened. Almost any will succumb to borers if they're there and exposed.
And that is a borer that tends to be attracted to stressed trees.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the telltale things, if you really want to look and see whether your other trees are becoming affected, you look toward the top of the tree. And typically you'll see them start to take out the top leaves. And so they work from the top down. And that gives you an opportunity, if you're noticing that you're losing leaves at the very top and you're losing some of that branch canopy, that gives you an opportunity to get somebody in there and get a treatment done so that you don't necessarily have to lose the tree. Mm-hmm. But it's catching it early and getting the appropriate products on it. Systemic products sometimes will work better depending on the size of the tree and the application, etc. But I would say take it down. If it is full of holes and you've lost a lot of canopy, and it appears as though the tissue is weakened on the tree, you don't want to leave it up just from a safety standpoint. Mm. If it's anywhere near walkways, people, et cetera. Most yards, you want to get a tree that's very impacted by insects or diseases. You want to get that remediated as fast as possible to minimize risk to people who are in the yard or the house, et cetera.
The other thing is to look at stresses on the trees.
Absolutely.
Because one of the things we tend to see is that people plant birch trees out in the middle of a yard where there's full sun, it's mm-hmm. very hot, and they'll have grass growing all the way up to the base. And the combination of the heat, the improper siting, and also a lot of actually water stress from the turf. The turf will actually absorb a lot of the moisture and it won't get to the tree. So if you've got a tree in a kind of less than optimal area, I would suggest removing the turf out to the drip line and then mulching that area mm-hmm. with about 2 to 4 inches of mulch, depending upon soil type. 2 inches if it's relatively heavy clay soil, up to about 3 to 4 inches if it's a sandier soil, and then supplemental watering if it gets dry in the summer.
But one thing that we commonly see with birch trees when they're placed in the landscape, and it looks lovely, so I can understand why people would want to do it, is they put stone around the base of a birch tree, which holds the heat in, which does not help the birch tree because it has a problem with heat tolerance here, not cold tolerance. And it has a problem with drought as opposed to moisture.
I have to say, my association with birch trees is huge birch forests in far northern Russia and Finland. So that makes us look like Florida here.
Yeah.
It does. And, you know, ours kind of wimp along. And and some of the work that they've been doing on new cultivars, it's good. And so you can, if you really do like having that look in the yard, you can do it. But it is it's watch the stresses on it. Make sure it's got moisture.
Proper siting when you put it
minimize
in.
Minimize the heat.
And definitely make sure it's getting enough water and it's in a relatively cool area.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Chris Molina, our on-air producer. Just want to let you know that Monday, Larry will be back, and at 11, physical therapists Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody will be with him to talk about how to keep making progress on those New Year's fitness goals, but avoiding injury at the same time. So that'll be, I think, a timely show to tune into. Right now it's Garden Talk, and we're talking with Brian Huddleston from the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic and Liz Freemuth of The Garden Hoe. And we have some lines open, so if you want to join in, you can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, and there's always our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Let's go back to the phones and Barb in Elkhorn. Hi, Barb.
Hello. I have a question for each of you. The first one is, for the first time last year, we had smut on our sweet corn. So I'm wondering how we can prevent that.
All right.
Yeah, one of the things you may want to do, sometimes it's very hit or miss whether you have this particular disease. And for people who don't know what common smut of corn looks like, if you've ever seen a corn plant with this big kind of grayish mass, usually on the ears, and then eventually it'll kind of turn brown and powdery and kind of break up. That's corn smut. And it can be very hit or miss from year to year. Oftentimes for home gardeners, what I recommend is you check when you're buying the sweet corn seed and find a variety that's been bred for resistance. Hmm. There are a fair number of varieties out there that should have a fairly high level of resistance because there's in commercial sweet corn production, there's very little tolerance for having corn smut in commercial fields. If you actually get the spores of this fungus in with canned corn, it can give the corn a very weird flavor.
Now, I know that there's a corn fungus that's actually a delicacy in some cuisines.
Yeah, it's
is
the
that
same
the same?
One.
Okay,
the same
so it's huilacoche.
Huilacoche is the Native American
just
name.
Just call it huilacoche instead.
Well, it's quite interesting because if you catch this fungus early on when it's still very fleshy before it started to powder up, you can harvest it and slice it and fried up like a mushroom. And it's quite frankly, if you look at how the fungus is classified compared to other fungi, the fungus is closely related to the button mushrooms that you buy in the grocery store. So you can use it. Some people actually want to inoculate their corn
to grow it
because you can sell it at the farmer's market for a fairly sizable amount of money. The last time I heard, I haven't gotten a quote recently, but somebody said they saw it being sold for $20 to $25 a pound.
Mm. That's so, up in the morel
category. Yeah, definitely. So you could potentially eat it if you like mushrooms, but you'd have to catch it very, very early. But if you're going after the sweet corn, I think resistant varieties are probably the way to go. The spores are going to be around. They tend to overwinter in the soil, and so they can get blown around in the wind. So I would go with the resistant.
We did try to cut it out and bag it up and not feed it to our chickens because I did read that if we feed it to the farm critters that it could be spread around throughout the yard.
Yeah, so that's a possibility. It could pass through the intestinal system and stick around. I think that's a good idea if you're trying to get rid of it. Again, I would select a different variety. Definitely check in your seed catalog because seed companies will advertise whether sweet corn varieties are smut resistant. It's an important enough disease that they advertise that.
And you had another question, Barb?
My other question was we've had a horrible time with squash borers and squash bugs. And last year, they pretty much decimated all of our squash. And the borers got in right at the base of the plant. So by the time I noticed it, it was too late, and we ended up losing a lot of our plants. And what the borers didn't kill off, the squash bugs just pretty much disappeared. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, Phil Pelletieri was just on Wednesday, and he was saying that it was a banner year for squash bugs. So maybe, with any luck, Barb, that was a one-off thing. Mm-hmm. But what about the... What about protecting against them?
How many plants are you taking care of? A lot or
last year we did plant a lot of squash. I bought some new varieties, some that were supposed to be resistant, but they weren't resistant. So I don't know if it's just because of the weather. But we've been having a problem with squash bugs for about 3 or 4 years, and last year was just the absolute worst. Last year was the first year we really had a big problem with the borers.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know enough about those insects to talk about them intelligently, but we do have fact sheets on both of those insects. I know that. So what I would recommend, are you hooked up to the internet?
I'm sorry, what?
Are you hooked up to the internet?
Yes, I am, and I do have some of your fact sheets.
Okay.
And I guess the part of the thing with the squash bugs is spraying of chemicals, and I don't like to use chemicals.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Last year, I finally did end up getting something in spraying because the squash bugs were just so bad.
Yeah, yeah, and there are chemicals out there. If you actually look under the certified organic, and I can't even think of what it's called. Is it? It's not CESA. There actually is an organic handbook of products that you can use for various insects and diseases. So if you're concerned about the chemical use, I would actually check with that. Otherwise, you can certainly go with row covers, but that has to be done very early and before insects even begin to rear their ugly heads.
Otherwise, you'll just be trapping
insects
in there.
You trap them in, and it's worse than anything. And so you really have to know what you're doing with row covers. And with squash, that can be really difficult to do well.
Yeah, I also think there are debris issues with overwintering, so you've got to make sure that you get that cleaned up. And again, I'm speaking off of having read these fact sheets ages ago. So what you may want to do is contact your county extension office for additional information and or call Phil Pelletieri for a consultation as well.
Yeah. And, the debris cleanup, move them if you can to an area that did not have anything related to squash planted in it within the last 3 to 4 years will actually do wonders for you. Absolutely wonders.
Great.
And, the debris, get that cleaned up. Mm-hmm. If you're rototilling debris back into the earth, make sure that you get, I would actually go to an area where, again, you didn't have anything in there for 3 to 4 years that could attract those insects.
Great. All right. Good luck with that, Barb. And let's go next to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
How are you doing? Thanks for calling and taking my call today. My question sort of goes back to the first subject about drought stress. I was getting lilacs in October. They
weren't
went dormant. The leaves started to fall off.
Gorgeous? Weren't they gorgeous when they bloomed again?
Oh, yeah. But the trouble is now I still have some of the buds left on the vine. Are they going to die off? Should I cut them off?
No.
Can be stress related, or
I would just leave them alone. I had magnolias that rebloomed in summer. I had lilacs that rebloomed. I just let them go. The season was long enough, and that was the major problem, is that we started very early last year with inciting growth. They bloomed. They had a bit of dormancy, and they bloomed again, but it was a light bloom. A lot of those will actually hold off just fine. Anytime you've got a spring blooming plant, whether it bloomed twice or not, unless you can tell the difference in the bud development at this time of the year. So you're looking for a specific size, shape, and where it occurs on the branch. If you start pruning away, you're going to prune your potential blooms off, or you have that potential to prune the blooms off. So you want to be a little bit cautious about that. If it's just taking off dead material, yes, pick a nice dry day, not today, a nice dry, cold, sunny day so that that tissue has a chance to close off. So nothing gets into it, no moisture gets into it, and so you don't get some ice damage. Pick a time when it's not icy, but quite honestly, I would just let it go. Make sure that it gets some water. Thank goodness we've got some rain right now, so that's a good thing for all of our plants out there. And then I would just make sure that early in the spring you get some moisture down if we've got a dry spring. And otherwise, I really wouldn't worry about it too much.
Okay, because we had a whole row by the fences. I hate to see it die off. So.
I hear you. But what? Lilacs are one of those that if this is an established planting and really it survived quite a bit, you could actually take a chainsaw to it after bloom time and they would come back just beautifully for the following year. They will respond very, very well. As long as it's not a grafted variety, you can take them down to the ground and they'll shoot runners out. So I would right now is a good time to do some selective pruning on branches that are dead in there and get those out so that that's not causing any further stress on that plant when spring does come. So get in there, get the dead stuff out, get the rubbing branches out, do some kind of really good shape pruning on those lilacs, but don't touch the ends.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, John. And I want to talk more about that winter pruning, but it looks like Aaron in Bessemer, Michigan, also has a pruning question, so let's go there first. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
About 2 years back, I have got two red currant bushes in my yard. My parents bought them, planted them there about 8-10 years ago. And they were getting really overgrown, so I late fall trimmed them back, took off the old growth, the oldest growth, And one came back, you know, in true colors and really good. The other one hasn't really had much in the lines of berries, or it just really sickly looking.
And
is there something that maybe I did wrong?
Were a lot of the branches that you were cutting off, were they dead?
A lot of them were dead. Some of them were still, they were getting pretty thick.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, according to what I've heard, is you take out the oldest growth,
yeah,
so the new
right.
growth can come in.
Were you decontaminating your tools as you were pruning?
No, I was not.
Yeah, my concern is maybe some of those dead branches that you were cutting through were actually infected with some sort of probably fungal pathogen. And you can actually pick up spores of the organism on your pruning tools. And then as you prune other branches, you can actually inoculate them that way. So when you're doing pruning again, I would routinely have a little container of either 10% bleach or probably better is 70% alcohol. Use something like rubbing alcohol, or you can even use spray disinfectants that tend to be
Dollar store is a wonderful place for disinfecting spray.
Just make sure that on the ingredient label, mm-hmm. it says that it's about 70% alcohol in the whatever you're buying, and spray until they drip and allow them to air dry. And that will help kill off, if you have spores of these sorts of organisms on the pruning tools, it will help kill those off so that you don't inoculate other branches. I'm suspicious that's part of what was going on.
Now, how old were they? How many years of growth did you have on them?
They were probably 4-year growth, ones I trimmed off.
Okay, so they weren't tremendously old.
Yeah, they weren't tremendously old.
Okay.
The bushes were getting really big. I was getting, you know, off of one bush, I get almost a gallon of berries.
Oh, yeah, wow.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, I am too. Do you have any pine trees around there, white pine?
I do have one white pine about 100 yards away from it.
What I would do is I would actually check out your white pine, make sure you don't have any white stuff on it, on the trunk. I worry whenever I hear currants and white pine together. There are some that are resistant to white pine blister rust, but most of them I do worry a little bit, and you can actually see slow decline in one or the other of those, and without really noticing a lot of symptoms. Did you notice any rusty powder on the leaves of the currants?
No, I didn't. I didn't notice.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
That
that's
would be one
thing
I would go out this year on the ones that are still growing and watch for that. You'll usually get these little masses of very dusty colored spores that will form on typically the undersurface of the leaves about midsummer. And I would check for that, because that's what this white pine blister rust organism looks like on currants.
Mm-hmm.
With the amount of dieback that you're talking about, I'd be a little bit surprised if that were the sole thing that's causing the problem. But that could be a contributor.
I was going to say I would worry more about it as another thing that could possibly go wrong. And with 100 yards, you're really at that stage where I wouldn't worry about it as much. But I have seen stuff really infect from further than that. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on the wind, et cetera. And it might have been that really it wasn't a tremendously healthy shrub anyway. You know, so I would do a wait and see. I don't know. What was your weather like over there? Did you guys have a lot of rain, or was it droughty?
It was pretty droughty. It wasn't too horrible. But I did put some... I got a compost bin, active compost bin, and then put some of the old compost around it, just to try to keep some of the moisture in.
Make sure when you're using your home compost to make sure it's heat treated if you put anything from the yard into it. So, I mean, we're looking at a temperature between 140 and 160. Otherwise, you can actually inoculate your stuff with pathogens. Just as a cautionary, you probably didn't do it with this, but just as a cautionary for future stuff, I would do a wait and see, because it was a stressful year. Pruning will have a tendency to weaken a plant further if it's been under stress, but I would give it a wait and see, because they can be pretty tough. If they're relatively healthy and they were producing pretty good for you, I'd do a wait and see. If you're seeing good growth come back this spring, fine. If not, I would say rip it out, go get another one and put it in. You know, we're not talking about a horribly traumatic thing unless this plant has meaning to you. personally.
All right. Thanks for that call, Aaron. And on the Facebook page, we had a question from Todd. He says, hi, guys. I have a lot near Hayward dominated by white pine trees. On many of the trees, I have pruned the lower branches 10 feet or more from the ground. Is this wise? And if so, when do I do the others? When I do the others, should I clean my saw or chainsaw while moving from tree to tree? And what type of solution should I use? So that's a great refresher.
Perfectly fits in, actually, with the last question.
Yes.
Because one of the things I was going to recommend is one of the ways to help manage white pine blister rust is to make sure that you prune up the branches of your white pines. And roughly 10 to 15 feet above ground is what we normally recommend.
Well, and quite honestly, I would say that if you don't prune your white pines 10 to 15 feet above ground, the deer will do a number on them anyway. And so they tend to look a little rangy kind of, you know, and so why not, you know,
right.
And that's an okay thing. If you don't mind the look where the branches are raised, then go for it. But the disinfesting is
the same thing that we talked about before, which is, and again, for something like a chainsaw, I think the spray disinfectants are the way to go because you can
definitely
get it into the little teeth. And
can't see dipping the end of a chainsaw, but you know, whatever.
And bleach tends to be a little corrosive on metal tools. So I think the spray disinfectants would work well. And definitely between trees is a good idea. If you're willing to do it more often, our optimal way of doing it is between every cut, but most of the time people don't want to do it that frequently, but definitely between trees.
And you know, really, once you start getting into pruning, you really can see healthy tissue versus unhealthy as kind of a first line. You mean there's a lot of things that you cannot see, pathogens that you cannot see. You may not see symptoms until it's further down the road. But if you're actually seeing an area that's sunken, that looks a little funky colored, don't cut through it unless you're going to disinfest before you move on to something else. And, you know, so that's just one of those things where, you know, look first.
Being aware.
Look first, but do be very cautious when you're going from tree to tree.
You do have to be cautious even because, like you said, some of the things that we're dealing with, not necessarily on pines, but if we're talking about pruning on something like elms or oaks, the pathogens I worry about, you're never going to see.
That's right.
And
that's
you can pick them up very easily on pruning tools.
And we often end up talking about white pines because they do have some serious problems. Is there a way, if you've got, you know, a pine tree in your yard and you're really not sure what it is there a way to tell if it's a white pine or not?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are a lot of great pictures out there.
Okay.
One of my favorite books is Michael Durr's Manual of Hardy Trees and Shrubs. It's the Bible of trees. But he also has pictures out there. And the Forest Service has got a phenomenal website where if you put in white pine, it will send you to a bunch of images of what white pine looks like. And you want to count the needle clusters. You look at the scale, you know, the scales that are around it. You look at all of that, and that will help you determine. Otherwise, you know, really there is a lovely extension system in the state where you can take samples in, and sometimes the master gardeners can identify them for you, and sometimes they can't, but, you know, they can at least point you in the right direction. Check out the garden centers that are in your area. There are a lot of knowledgeable people at garden centers that can take a look at a branch or a cluster of needles and say, oh, yeah, you know, that's what this is. Yeah. Or take it in and go from tree to tree in their lot for what's for sale and do, oh, okay, I think I know it's kind of in this family.
Game.
Yeah, when you start to get into cultivars within, then it gets a little bit difficult.
But just to get kind of the broad identification.
Yeah, if you can sort of get in the right area so that you know what you're looking for, sometimes it's just a matter of the underside color of a needle, whether it's this cultivar or that cultivar. Hmm. Now you're talking about something very, very special. Specialized. Okay. And that can be a little bit difficult to do. But Forest Service, Extension, you know, the garden centers, there's a lot of sources out there.
And we have a woody ornamental specialist in the extension
phenomenal
system.
Phenomenal one, yeah.
Laura Jull.
Laura Jull, who's often a guest on Garden Talk as well.
And if you get a sample into the county extension office and the folks there can identify it, they can take pictures or forward it on to Laura and she can ID it for you.
Well, and that's, you know, wonderful. We've got all of these digital tools at our disposal that you can get very, very good pictures.
Right.
So you really don't even have to have an actual
Phil Pelletieri actually was saying on Wednesday that it's been striking in the last 10 years.
Yes,
how
right.
many more? It's the high quality digital images that the extension offices can provide him of insects that people bring in
yeah.
that a huge percentage of his ID work now is done with those digital images instead of little bugs getting mailed in pill bottles.
Unfortunately, that doesn't work as well for what I do, because most of what I'm looking for pathogen-wise is microscopic.
And I'm just amazed at how much the equipment has come down in price, because it's now affordable for less than $300 to get a microscope with a digital camera on it.
Wow.
And, you know, that wasn't the case even 5 years ago. So it's much easier for those of us that are kind of geeks about stuff like that to be able to have tools and toys.
And to share information.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's great.
You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller, talking with Brian Huddleston from the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and Liz Freemuth, the garden hoe, who provides concierge services for horticulture clients around the state. Chris Molina is our on-air producer, and we will be back in just a moment. Very happy to have you along for Garden Talk today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have quite a few people waiting online to ask their questions, so let's go right back to the phone. And Sally in Superior. Hi, Sally.
Hi. I'm right outside of Superior, but anyway, I had impatiens last year in a new bed, a raised bed, and they did great till about the 1st of August, and then they just kind of died off. And I had a friend who said it was mold. Now, it didn't look like powdery mold, but it did look kind of funky underneath. And the plants just, I mean, they looked like they needed water, but they didn't, and they just died.
Okay, well, let's see what they have to say.
Did they totally die back, or did it just kind of defoliate, and you were left with kind of bare branches?
It kind of, I didn't leave them get completely died back when they looked that way. I pulled them out.
You pulled them out, which was actually a good thing to do if it's the disease that I was thinking of. So you kind of implied that you were able to see some maybe whitish material on the undersurface of the leaves?
It really wasn't whitish. It was just kind of whatever. I have a friend who's a master gardener, and he hadn't pulled all of them out yet, and he came and he looked and he said, that's mold.
Yeah, I'm betting it could very well have been downy mildew, which was a real problem across the United States this past summer.
See, we didn't have drought up here, really.
Mm-hmm. And that would have been
later in the fall.
Really great conditions for downy mildew to be an issue. And this is a disease. We see downy mildews on a variety of different types of crops. Probably where people see it most often is on grapes. If you ever get kind of white, fuzzy grapefruits, that's a downy mildew typically. And we had a variant that got on in patients this year. I saw my first case in, I think, August that came in from Northern Illinois. And then I went to visit my parents, and my mother had it all over her yard on her impatiens.
So she was just thinking about you.
Yes, indeed. Probably was thinking I inoculated her plant.
She thought, I'll save this for Brian. He'll enjoy this.
And this particular disease causes a lot of defoliation. Initially, what you tend to see is some yellowing of the foliage and kind of distortion. The leaves will kind of cup. But if you catch it early, if you flip those leaves on the over and look at the undersurface, you're going to see some kind of whitish material on the undersurface of the leaves. And it can vary a little bit in terms of color, but this particular downy mildew tends to be relatively white. What I would suggest is exactly what you did, was to remove the plants. If you have this occur again, well, first thing, when you go to plant impatiens next year, don't plant them in as large a masses as people typically do. Do a few plants here or there. You're less likely to have a serious problem.
And should she avoid that area?
I would avoid that particular area. Most of the time, this organism is going to tend to survive in dead plant, impatient material. Mm-hmm. There is some possibility that there might be some of the organism in the soil. So I do think moving to a new location is a good idea. And then space the plants far apart. And make sure there's good airflow between the plants so that if they get wet, they dry really quickly. This particular organism, in order for the reproductive structures to germinate, they need a period where the leaves are wet, and it sounds like you had pretty good conditions for
so
that to happen.
So making sure there's that good airflow.
Good airflow, good rapid drying, using interspacing the impatiens with other types of plants kind of as a physical barrier is a good idea. And if you like New Guinea impatiens, they tend to be a little bit more resistant or tolerant of this particular disease. You won't see as severe damage, and that would be something else you could do as well. There certainly are fungicide treatments you could try, but I think for home gardeners, some of these more cultural methods are the way to go.
And I think when you're looking at the New Guinea impatiens, the Sun Patience series is one of the most resistant. I have seen virtually nothing on them down south, wherever I've been, full sun, shade, they look absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that something won't pop up that does take them out eventually, but for the time being, they work very well.
Yes, they're performing very well, and they do give you lots to choose from as far as color in the leaves and the flowers. So that is definitely one that if you didn't like them before, you know, if it was something that you tried early on when they were introduced into the market, you know, it was a little like, yeah, not so. Now the breeding is doing much better with it, and you can get a lot of choices.
Great. Well, good luck with that, Sally. And let's go next to David in Dodgeville. Hi, David.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a question about asparagus. I hear you putting salt on to keep the grass and weeds down. How about mulching? I don't hear much about that. Am I going to cause problems or...
No, not at all. Salting, that's something that comes from old wives' tale, et cetera, but I've never been a fan of salting anything. I think that when you're talking about an asparagus bed, you really want to maintain decent pH, you want to maintain decent soil health. Mulching, if it's a good mulch that actually you know you don't have extra pathogens in, et cetera, is fantastic. How big of a bed are we talking about?
I think it's probably 3 foot wide, 10 foot long.
Okay. Are you in an area where you can burn?
Yeah.
What I do with mine in the spring is I do a burn early in the season. And so any of that errant stuff that didn't develop an aversion to my asparagus bed on its own in late in fall, which is, you know, there's stuff there. I burn it off in the spring and then get some mulch down on it and, you know, get the remains of any perennial roots and stuff like that out of there. And to me, that's a much better approach than trying to control it with chemicals or trying to control it with salt. You know, we see the stuff that we can control it with salt or vinegar, bleach, etc. Anytime you're doing any of that in large doses, you are doing just as bad as putting down harsh chemicals onto the soil. So, you know, just use your common sense. Mulching, to me, is a much better thing to do.
Yeah, a couple of comments. If you are going to burn, I would definitely check with your local municipality.
Absolutely.
To see if there are any permits or anything that you need before you do that and any precautions that they suggest. It's not necessarily a bad thing to do, but you do need to be aware of that.
Absolutely.
You can't get ticketed if you do it the wrong way. The other thing with the mulches, if you tend to use a lot of grass clippings, make sure they're well composted and also...
And chemical-free.
Yes. If you use a lawn product, fertilizer, a weed and feed sort of material on your lawn, some of the herbicides that are in those materials can carry over in the clippings, and those will adversely affect things like asparagus and a lot of other types of plants as
well. Anytime anybody is using mulch around vegetable products, my preference is that this is something that is a well-seasoned, well-heated, well-cared-for compost or mulch, so that you're getting that temperature up to 140 or 160 internal. It's being turned. If you're making it yourself, I like slow, hot compost as opposed to fast, quick turnaround, because you're not then introducing pathogens and weed seeds into an area that you're trying to prevent pathogens and weeds from growing into.
Yeah. So, and it gives a period of time for any of those chemicals that may be in the grass to break down.
Yeah, and I really am not a fan of using grass that's been treated on anything, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. To me, that's something that, I'm not a big fan of it at all.
All right. Thanks for that call, David. And just to go over that burning idea. So is it the same concept as burning your prairie, that the weeds come up first and you get rid of them before those native plants, or in this case, the asparagus, comes up?
Yeah. And actually, that kind of it was born out of that. I help in the neighborhood when we burn prairies, acres of prairie. And I thought, you know what, I'm burning all this other stuff and then I'm out there hand weeding my asparagus bed. The heat will take care of some of those weed seeds that are on the surface that were not taken care of appropriately. It will kill off the debris left from any of the annuals, the annual weeds that are there. And so, yes, it's basically the same. You want to get it before the asparagus is poking up, though, or else you're going to hurt your shoots.
Hmm. And it's not going to be a standalone treatment for weed
control. It's not an end-all be-all either. You do need to maintain good health in that asparagus bed throughout the year also, but it's a good cleanup method.
It just kind of gets you off on a good
start. It does, and it really, you know, to me, it's a cathartic thing in the spring. Let's go burn some stuff.
There you go. Well, I want to make sure that we talk about how people, both of you are such great resources, how people can get more information. Liz, I know that you said that you are a crazy tweeter. So if people do Twitter, where can they find you?
This is just nutso. It's at Liz, L-I-S, the Garden Ho. So it's LISTHEGARDENHOE. But if you go into Twitter and you search for the Garden Ho, you'll see there's a nice picture on there, and I'll be there. But yeah, I'm absolutely loving it. I think it's because my attention span is about 140 characters. And I do try to do pictures. So if there's plants out there that I'm looking at or something that I'm doing, I'll take a picture and put that out there also for people. So otherwise, they can go to my website, www.thegardenho.com.
And again, we usually make a point of saying it's ho with an E.
With an E.
In case anyone was confused.
I'm a handy tool in the garden.
There you go. And Brian, as you said, you're really excited about your revamped website.
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about what's there and how people can find it.
All of our one-page fact sheets are available there. You can find information about the clinic. There's a calendar if you are interested in booking me for a talk. You can find out when I'm available. I also link handouts that I give for some of my other talks, so if you want to see what sort of things I talk about. There's information on submitting a sample and contact information. If you have a question, you can give me a shout either by phone or by email.
What are some of those topics of those informational
papers? Oh, we have over 200 titles. So it's all the way from diseases, insects, and general horticulture. So pretty much the gambit.
Great.
And if anyone has suggestions on things that we write on, we're always looking for new topics.
And is there a charge to submit a sample to the
lab? It runs roughly $20 to $25 per sample, depending upon what we have to do with the sample. You don't have to pay up front. We will send you a report in the mail and then bill you when we send the report.
And you know, it's money so well spent. So well spent.
And that's www.pddc.wisc.edu.
There's a dot between the www and the PDDC, and you don't even have to use the www.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and this is Garden Talk. A lot of us really love getting out and getting our hands dirty in the garden. Some plants seem to grow well no matter what, while others are really susceptible to pests and disease. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Our Garden Talk guests today have lots of great advice for a healthy garden. Liz Freemuth was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of The Garden Ho, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She provides concierge horticulture services. Liz, thanks for coming by today.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
And Brian is Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's go right back to the phones because we have some folks that have been waiting a little while. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Don in Warren, Illinois has a question. Hi, Don.
Hi. Reforesting problem. I have a large area that I would like to plant. I have direct planted walnuts, hickory nuts, the oaks, all that I can get a hold of. All I'm doing is feeding the squirrels, it seems. Anyway, I'm not getting any growth. When is the right time? I spent 10 years before the internet, trying to get chestnuts to grow until I finally figured out and read all how to do it. I have, like I said, direct planted and had no success. Should I bed plant these nut trees? And if so, what are the criteria? You know, they need frost or no frost or what?
How many acres are you doing?
Nuts. Beg pardon?
How many acres are you doing?
Lots.
Okay.
Like
yeah. Nuts are a little difficult to do from seed. Where are you getting your seed from?
Local.
Okay. Are you collecting them from various and sundry people under their trees and
right,
whatnot? Okay.
Right.
Okay. One thing that you do have to be a little concerned of, and you know, we minimize this and we talked about it briefly before, is anytime you've got chemicals going on somebody's yard that can impact the viability of anything that's there, that can include nuts. But if you're collecting them in the fall and if you're putting them into the ground right away, I don't know if they're going to be getting enough cold treatment. If you take a look at what nature does, you actually get those nuts that fall They get a little bit of moisture in the fall. They get some cold. Generally, you have some leaves or debris fall on them, and that's where you get a little bit of cover, and it'll start to grow. So if you're simulating that with what you're doing, you should actually be okay, except that, like you said, you're feeding the squirrels and you're feeding the chipmunks. If you're not having success with emulating nature with the nuts, what I would suggest doing is, like you said, bed them out, grow them. What you may be better off doing is actually containerizing them, unless you're pretty good at harvesting bare root and then transplanting those. If you containerize them, you'll have less damage to any of the tap roots that develop, and you'll have better success that way. So it's really, you know, if you're talking about doing a lot of acres, bare root, that's going to be cost prohibitive for you to do. You can try and do cuttings. That does work fairly well on some of the trees. But I think development-wise, if you can fine-tune your bed planting of the nuts and get those out there, you probably will be okay. Early spring, before growth starts, is the time to transplant anything that you do have started and get that out there before you actually see some sap moving.
Is there any book that would
yes.
I have tried to raise American chestnuts for the last 25 years, and yeah. I spent 10 years of my life making the wrong moves. Chestnuts cannot stand freezing. They cannot stand drying.
I think if you go to some very good, reliable sources, again, I go to Michael Durr's work on trees. He has an excellent book on propagation techniques. But his main book, and you know, if you don't want to invest in it yourself because it's a fairly pricey book, ask a library to get it for you, because most of them will get it in and you can go in and take a look. He gives specific propagation techniques and methods and requirements for the species that are out there. So that will give you a little bit of a leg up. There are a lot of other places that you can go to get decent information. If you're not connected to the internet, I would say go to your local Extension Forest Service Conservation Department. Conservation Department people should be able to help you out quite a bit with getting the right sources for materials, etc. And that should at least give you a little bit of a helping hand. If you're trying to get chestnuts going, I would actually say if you want to start with something like that with bare root, find a good supplier for bare root chestnuts and go with that rather than, you know, enjoy your next 25 years of growing them rather than banging your head against the wall when they won't grow. So start with a bare root on those and find a good one and work from there.
And the unfortunate part is once you get the chestnuts to a decent size, then they'll probably
die.
Get infected mm-hmm. from succumb to chestnut blight. It won't typically kill the trees, but it'll take out the main trunk and then they'll sprout yeah. and you end up with basically kind of a shrub.
Which are quite lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's just you have to lower your expectations
right. you
slightly.
You have to have different expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Well, good
exactly.
luck with that, Don. And
I applaud him for doing that. You know, I love it when people do stuff like that.
Great. All right, well, let's go to John in Milwaukee next. Hi, John.
Good afternoon to you.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my question. You had conversations earlier on white pine disease, and my question is related to that. I have a couple of blue spruces that are dying back. Some branches are dying back. It looks like there's some black growth on some of the fronds or the branches. And these tall 30, 40 feet blue spruces, and I've got one that's about 8 feet tall, too, that are dying back. Looks like they have some disease. Are very near my neighbor's white pines that have the rust or the disease okay. in which they are dying back.
Well, Brian is nodding knowingly, so let's yeah. see what Brian has to say.
You're primarily seeing dieback from the bottom up?
Yeah, from the bottom up.
Yeah.
Also, I think I heard another show in which the commercial lawn people using some weed killers, grass weed killers.
I think that was the Imprellis.
Yeah,
right?
I kind of doubt that that's what you're dealing with the blue spruce.
Yeah, you wouldn't see them languishing. You'd see them dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brian, what do you think? What you're dealing with on those branches that are losing needles, do you still, on some of them, have little tufts of green needles at the tips?
Yes.
Then it's probably a disease called rhizosphera needle cast. We do have a fact sheet on this as well. I'll plug that while we talk about this. It's a fungal disease. And it's very common on Colorado blue spruce. It basically is the reason I no longer recommend Colorado blue spruce as a landscape tree. The trees tend to be very susceptible to disease. The needles become infected oftentimes when they're first emerging, but you don't see any symptoms until they kind of age and end up farther back on the branches. And then the needles will start to turn brown or purple and then fall off. And you're going to have to live with it on these older trees because it's well past the point where you can do anything. Again, the best management for this disease is don't plant a Colorado blue spruce. If the trees are looking really ratty at the bottom, then I would simply prune those lower branches. Follow the instructions that we talked about in terms of disinfesting tools earlier on as you're doing that. The pathogen is not likely to go to white pine. There are variants that can of this fungus that can go to white pine, but it's not a serious disease on white pine. If your neighbors are having white pines with a problem, it's probably something else other than Rhizosphera.
And we have actually out for clients, we've had some success if we can catch early. We can keep some growth coming on the ends of the branches, but you're not talking about something that's easy to manage and you never get full control.
Right.
You just get enough management so that you get some needles developing on the outer ends of the branches.
And it tends to involve fungicide applications every year, multiple applications, and that gets very expensive and tiresome after a while.
And you have to really, it has to be somebody who's committed to actually seeing those trees stay. Mm. And right about the time where they're starting to develop into decent size, decent shape is when they start to really go downhill.
10 to 15 years is when I normally start seeing this disease. Although on younger trees, if they're crowded and they're in an environment that's a little bit more moist, then we'll start to see the disease earlier.
Yeah, and stress does wonderful things for egging it on.
Well, we had very wet springs in 2009 and 2010, and then with the drought, that just stresses those needles that are infected and causes them to shed earlier.
And one thing that we forget about also are the irrigation systems that we have in place in our landscapes that spray the lawn, and they keep
also
those
the
needles.
Trees.
Yeah, they keep the needles nice and wet. And you know, if conditions are good and you're providing that moisture, and that's that last little bit that needs to be there to pop that disease open, there you go. And so my one of the first things I do almost always when I go to a client's place to look at what the problems are is to ask them to turn on the irrigation system so that I can see where it's landing and what it's hitting and how often do you run it and what time do you run it. Those are very important in disease control. It's a small thing that you can do to actually start managing diseases.
Yeah. For your specific situation, the branch pruning is probably about all you're going to be able to do to make the trees look nicer. And you may have to prune up so far that you basically end up with a tree that you don't really like, in which case then you start to think about removal and replacement with something else.
Yeah. And actually, talking about replacement, Brian, if someone likes the look of a blue spruce, what is there an option? Obviously, it's not going to look exactly the same, but is there an option that's much more resistant to pathogens?
What I like as a alternative to Colorado blue spruce that has similar coloring and softer needles, I don't like things that hurt me when I garden, and spruces tend to do that, is if you have good soil drainage and are willing, if it gets dry, to water, then I would suggest a white fir. Concolor fir is a very nice tree and beautiful soft needles, same color. And it can be a very, very lovely tree.
I've actually had really good luck with Serbian spruce also.
Yes.
That has a little bit more of an open habit. Mm-hmm. And some of the cultivars that are out there will give you a coloration similar to blue spruce. You're not going to get that blue that you can really get in a good blue spruce. Otherwise, if it's something that you want to plant, really taking care of a blue spruce from day one is important. And that's thinning the branches out, and you may even have to do some preventative fungicide applications.
Don't crowd them at all.
Don't crowd them, and give them plenty of space, and don't touch them, don't look at them, don't breathe on them after about 15 years, and you should be okay. In a good spot with good airflow and good overall health, they can really look quite good, but that's very rare.
Yeah, and I never see good-looking ones.
Yeah, no, you don't. I see a few, but not a lot of them.
Well, thanks for that call. And we had a question from Kathy on Facebook. She says, my Rudbeckia goldstrom does not do well. It suffers from some type of wilt. I'm planning to tear it out, and I'm looking for another yellow flowering plant to replace it with. It gets full sun from 10 a.m. till sunset.
I wonder what she means by wilt, because I can think of two different things that might be. There's a leaf disease called septorial leaf spot, which will cause browning and the plants will kind of die back. Mm-hmm. If it's a true wilt, where the plants are just getting really droopy, mm-hmm. but staying pretty green when that happens, then I'd worry about verticillium wilt.
Yeah.
And knowing whether or not you have verticillium wilt can be really important to select an alternative. So that
Definitely.
Would be something where I would suggest her getting a plant in so that we can test to find out exactly what it is, and then we can make recommendations.
If you're looking at things that, you know, given life is good and you don't have verticillium, et cetera, things that are unusual that work in kind of odd spots, helenium is one that I don't know if that's susceptible to vert. So again, that's like a huge question. But there are lovely yellow flowering heleniums out there that will tolerate wet feet. When I hear that, you know, if it isn't a leaf problem, it potentially may be too much moisture for a Rudbeckia. And if you've got soil moisture, heleniums love it. And so that's one that you can use for. It's easier to find now. It responds very well to pruning about the same time you do mums. So you can cut it back and keep it short. That was always a problem with some of the older cultivars is they got a little bit too leggy and they tended to fall over. You can cut them back and they'll do just fine. Hypericum, St. John's wort, is really good. Yeah. And Ames is a nice one. I've had really good luck with Ames. That's nice and cold hardy. And they can be a little bit slow to get going. It's a small shrub, but it responds well to pruning. And it will give you yellow throughout the season. The leaf color is good. And intermittent blooms. It's really better in later summer. But it is a nice shrub, and Ames has got bluer foliage on it, so you've got multiple interests going on.
All right.
That's at least two.
Yeah, but it just to repeat, Brian,
suggest that when she starts to see the problem next year, to get a plant in, dig it up, send her roots, stems, flowers, everything for us to take a look at, because we can evaluate it for the leaf diseases, the verticillium wilt, and also root rot issues.
Yeah, and you know, if people have specific questions about things like that, if they know what they're looking for, if they know what disease they have, and they want some suggestions for plants, feel free to email me at my website. Just go to the website contact page and email me and I get back to you, usually at 2 o'clock in the morning. Okay. But I get back to you with some suggestions as to what you can use.
Great. All right, let's go back to the phones and Brandon in Neillsville. Hi, Brandon.
Hello. My question is, I have a wild grape vineyard. I pulled them out of a pine tree orchard about 2 years ago. They're about 50 to 80 years old, 7 25-foot rows, and I'm at the bottom of low-lying land to get a lot of field runoff. I got high nitrogen and phosphates in the soil, but the grapes do decently well, and I want to do some fertilizing this spring, and I'm wondering what other nutrients I might have to add to the soil to help the grapes grow more.
Answer with that is do a soil test. You're really probably getting plenty of nitrogen if you've got runoff. You probably are getting plenty of phosphorus, et cetera. And so what I would do, and because this is a specific crop that you're looking for getting some help, I would do a soil test and make sure that you put on that soil test that these are for grapes and that they're for wild grapes, because that will determine what sort of a recommendation they're going to do for you. Well, you know, it'll be a better recommendation. And I would take it from a number of different places. So you may even want to do 3 or 4 separate samples for that size of a lot. Generally, what people will tell you is to put it into one. I don't. I will do from 3 or 4 different spots and send those in as separate samples to get recommendations.
And are you absolutely sure that the plants that you transplanted are truly grapes? Because we had a photograph of a plant that came through. Somebody said, oh, I have this new grape that's growing in my grape arbor. Can I mix the grapes with my other grapes to make jelly? It turned out to be Virginia creeper, which is poisonous. So definitely make sure. And Virginia creeper.
An old Concord that has been there.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry to, I don't want to.
No, that's great information.
I just want to make sure that we're not poisoning people here. And I agree with everything Liz said about taking samples and getting a soil test.
To me, that's the best thing to do, because you don't know if you didn't have one when you started. You need one for where you're at right now to kind of give you a baseline. And depending on how good you keep tabs on the fertilization, I would do one, especially if you want premium crops out of these, I would do one every year to see how you're doing, at least for 2 or 3 years. And then you can sort of play it by ear for a couple, and you know, then go to every 4 to 5 years for a soil sample, just so that you're getting the right nutrients in there so you get good growth.
And that's something you can do through your extension office, correct?
Yeah,
that's
either right. That or right through the soil lab too. I've sent them, and you can do also you can do the co-ops in the area. Well, they send them to the same soil lab generally.
Yeah. oftentimes the county extension offices will actually have packets.
Yes, that with they'll have everything.
They can lend you an auger to collect the sample. They'll have a package and directions on how to do it.
Great. Thanks for that call, Brandon. And Jenny from Sussex called with a question. She bought a brilliant red chokeberry plant that's looking a bit bare. It was a clearance item at the end of the season.
Love it.
Love it. The instructions say to prune back in late winter, and she's wondering whether or not it's appropriate to do so, considering how bare the plant is already.
I would let it go. Okay. I would give it a good year to really develop it. That's one of the recommendations that has changed over the years. Initially, you know, like maybe if you're looking 15 years or so ago, people were told to take off top the shrub, top the tree, take off some of that foliage. Well, that sends a mixed message to that plant. It's you're now telling that plant it needs to develop top growth while it's trying to develop roots. And what you want to do is minimize the stress on the top, let it develop the roots over a couple of years, and then about year three or four, unless they're dead branches, then you can start looking at shaping and pruning and cutting back to really get the good foliage color. Otherwise, I wouldn't do anything with it other than just keep tabs on it. If there's something that's diseased or dead, go ahead, cut it out, but otherwise just let it go.
All right. And Mike from Oshkosh is next. Hi, Mike.
Hello, hello. Question for you. What with global warming and planting zones changing and everything, I'm wondering about planting a sycamore tree. I know in the past they were not recommended for this area. It's something that grows in warmer climate, but mm-hmm. I really like sycamore trees.
I do too. I love them. I love the way they look. And you'll be very happy to know that some of the breeding that's being done out there, we're getting some that are a little bit more cold hardy. And you're right. I'm actually looking at zone 6 plants I'm going to try out this year to see what kind of protection I need to give them to get them to survive. We'll see exactly how warm this global is going to get. But they can be beset with some issues, some health issues, if they're not happy. So you want to make sure that you're getting something that is really, really cold hardy. And I would look, there's some great breeders up in your part of the state. So I would look around. Otherwise, I know if you go online and look at Beaver Creek Nursery, which is just down into Illinois, they have got some things in there under sycamores that you might want to take a look at. And even though it's a wholesale nursery, you can go in and access their information on plants.
Yeah, the one thing I would caution that you may have some problems with on that particular tree is there's technically it's a leaf disease on most trees called anthracnose, but on this particular host, we do see a lot of movement of the pathogen into the branch tips. So you may get some branch dieback that's from this particular disease, and you'll have to manage that through pruning.
Yeah, but otherwise it's really a lovely tree.
Oh, I love those trees.
I'm from
central Illinois originally, and we had a sycamore in our yard as a kid, and I just love that tree because it always looks like it's absolutely dead in the wintertime, and then out comes this beautiful foliage.
You know, I never understood the term tree hugger until I saw my first sycamore being from Wisconsin. You know, we didn't see those. And when you actually cannot resist going up to the tree and hugging it, you know, and that's what a sycamore does to me. The bark is gorgeous. The leaves are phenomenal. Yeah.
Well, that was a very heartwarming call to end on there. We'll all go out and hug. Even if we can't hug a sycamore, we can hug another tree.
There is one near me and here in Madison, so I can tell you where it is.
Well, they have one at the Botanic Garden, too, in Madison.
That's right.
Well, I want to make sure people know how to find both of you after the show. So, Liz, give us your website and also your Twitter handle.
Absolutely. www.thegardenhoe.com. And it is T-H-E, thegardenhoe.com, because there is only one of me. And Twitter is at Liz, L-I-S, The Garden Hoe.
All right. And Brian, your website?
Is pddc.wisc.edu. All of my contact information is there.
And that is the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at the UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. Brian Huddleston, Liz Freeman, thanks so much. It was a lot of fun, as always.
Thanks for having us.
And on Monday, Larry will be back, and physical therapists Bill Boisenault and Lori Time Brody will be with him to talk about how to keep making progress on those New Year's fitness goals while avoiding injuries. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network.